From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, President Obama comes to upstate New York. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, will share his thoughts on the president's visit, and we'll take a look at the coming implementation of the Affordable Care Act in New York. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. President Obama toured upstate New York this week, advocating a three-point plan he believes could make college more affordable for the middle class. At a speech at a Syracuse high school, Obama said the first prong would make colleges and universities more accountable for the product they put out.
I'm directing my administration to come up with a new rating system for colleges that will score colleges on opportunity, whether they're helping students from all kinds of backgrounds succeed, and on outcomes, whether students are graduating with manageable debt, whether they're actually graduating in the first place.
Obama is also proposing that colleges embrace more innovation to offer a better education and to help students manage debt. The average college student now graduates with $26,000 of debt, and the president says that creates a drag on the economy. And he said it's time students and families had a tool to help them decide which college can provide the best value for them.
Whether students are graduating with manageable debt, whether they're actually graduating in the first place, whether they have strong career potential when they graduate. That's the kind of information that will help students and parents figure out how much value a particular college truly offers.
Speaking at Henninger High School in Syracuse this week, he highlighted a set of initiatives that would see colleges ranked on affordability and educational outcomes. He also proposed an expansion of his existing pay-as-you-earn program that would allow students to cap their college debt payments at 10% of their monthly incomes, a move that would require congressional approval. High school student Cushay Island says the expansion of the pay-as-you-earn program could make the idea of college loans less frightening for many students.
It was very encouraging to me because I'm just becoming a senior, and it gave me ideas to what I really want to do with college and if I really want to take out loans. And if it's helpful for me to take out loans.
Obama continued his tour to Binghamton in New York and then to Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he was met by Vice President Joe Biden. Meanwhile, New York Governor Cuomo skipped most of the president's upstate swing this week, preferring to greet the president in Buffalo and then attending the state fair in Syracuse on his own. That story from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Cuomo initially said he would only be able to greet the president when Mr. Obama arrived in Buffalo because he had to get his daughters ready for college. But after meeting the president on the tarmac and listening to his speech at the State University at Buffalo, the governor found time to stop by the state fair in Syracuse, where he toured the sites with his three daughters and ate the obligatory sausage. Cuomo says he discussed the president's plan to make higher education more affordable when he briefly met with Mr. Obama.
Have the president here, and this is a vitally important topic. Everyone knows they need a college education, they just don't know how they're going to pay for it.
It's an issue the governor, with twins off to Brown and Harvard, says he can relate to.
You're telling me I almost couldn't afford the sausage.
Cuomo will also not be joining President Obama in Binghamton on the second day of the president's upstate New York tour. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, well, the president came, and it was an interesting visit. He toured upstate New York and some of Pennsylvania. It had to do mostly with college costs. but sort of surrounding this whole thing is the governor of New York and the issue of hydrofracking. They greeted in Buffalo and then parted ways.
Well, that's right. Andrew Cuomo, as I have noted before, has a 63% approval rating, quite high, and the president doesn't. He's got about 40. So if I know the way in which this governor thinks, he says, well, it would be disrespectful for me not to show up to greet the president. And I have my own political ambitions, and if I try to undercut him, somebody's going to undercut me later on. So he shows up, he greets him. But the one thing Andrew Cuomo now knows is that the hydrofracking is a monster. He never expected it to be. He thought it was going to be something that would help his reputation upstate. It would create jobs, he thought. And then all of a sudden, out came Natalie Merchant and all of the people who were so effective at all of this, and Josh Fox, and all of these people created an atmosphere in which we began to doubt. We say, well, does it really cause earthquakes? Does it really pollute our water? What are some of the other ancillary issues that come to it? Don't do it until you know more about it. The governor retreated. First, the Department of Environmental Conservation had to do a report. They got tens of thousands of negative comments. Then they laid it all off on the Department of Health. We still really haven't heard from the Department of Health on it. I have a feeling we're not going to hear much from Andrew Cuomo about hydrofracking, that's for sure. However, the president comes in, and it's so fascinating because, you know, people like this president in New York, and they don't want to be disrespectful. So I think that while the protesters were out, they weren't out with the same vehemence they were out with Andrew. Go explain it. I can't. I can only tell you that there are times when people you like do things you don't like and you ignore them.
Finally, Alan, an interesting story appeared in the Albany Times Union this week. Rick Carlin, the reporter. The headline, Auditor is Audited in Battle of Audits.
David, this has gotten to be personal. Here's what. The controller's job is to audit the agencies of state government. The controller has been doing it and doing it well. Tom DiNapoli was elected by the legislature and then elected by the people to be the controller. His predecessor was Alan Hevesy. He got himself into a lot of trouble. In fact, went to prison. As a result, the legislature passed a bill which allows the governor's people to go in and basically audit the controller every once in a while. But we know that this governor never liked Tom DiNapoli. We don't really know why. There have been a lot of things advanced. DiNapoli's done a very good job. Maybe it's that DiNapoli was favored by Speaker Silver. Maybe it's that Governor Cuomo was interested in sort of ethnic balancing the political ticket and having different kinds of people on it. And DiNapoli's Italian as he is. That has been suggested. I don't know if any of that is true. I'm just saying, what is true is that it's clear that this governor has been after DiNapoli. Now, one of the things that's very interesting here is that there's a great deal of money involved. The governor of New York knows that DiNapoli is the sole trustee of the multi-billion dollar pension fund. And there are those in and around the controller's office who suspect that part of what all of this is, that the governor comes in and they do an audit on the controller and the controller answers all the questions, answers them well, and they come up with what could only be seen as a rather silly thing about the computers that the controller has being too old. Well, the controller has requests in for better computers. They're going to get better computers. There's no question about it. But this is hardly the stuff that should lead to the governor somehow getting his hands on the voting of those stock shares and the control of that. And I think that when the smoke clears, we're going to see that this is really a battle over who gets to run the various pension money in New York State and to handle it.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. With some uncertainty and much anticipation, New Yorkers join all Americans in preparing for a monumental change in the nation's health care. As the Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports, proponents of the Affordable Care Act believe it should not be feared but embraced, and they aim to set the course of public perception in a friendly direction.
Public health exchanges are scheduled to begin operations October 1st. They were created by federal mandate to make affordable health insurance available to everyone. Predictions are that most consumers will see changes in their coverage. Elizabeth Benjamin, Vice President of Health Initiatives for the Community Service Society of New York, contends that New York is the state that benefits the most under Obamacare.
In New York, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, will result in a decline in individual market health insurance prices by a magnitude of, on average, 53%. Starting January 1st, New Yorkers will see incredible savings if they were, you know, had to buy health insurance out on the open market on their own. People with job-based coverage will see some increases, but not the sort of exponential double-digit increases we were seeing 3-4 years ago before the passage of the act. For New Yorkers, Obamacare is really, you know, we've hit the jackpot.
Recent news that United Parcel Service plans to remove thousands of spouses from its medical plan so they can find coverage via the health exchanges has caused much concern. The health law requires large employers to cover employees and dependent children, but not spouses or domestic partners. UPS expects the move to save about $60 million annually. On top of that, USA Today reports workers can expect more of this sort of sudden loss of spousal coverage under their employers' health insurance plans. New York leads the pack in spending money on navigators, $27 million so far. Seen as crucial to the success of the Affordable Care Act, navigators have been designated to quell confusion and address the fears associated with the new health insurance markets. Kevin Jobin Davis, executive director of the not-for-profit Healthy Capital District Initiative, concedes people have many questions about the Affordable Care Act.
It's particularly beneficial to people who have incomes between, say, 200% and 400% of the poverty line. For those individuals and families, they will get a subsidy that will help them defray the cost of their insurance that was never available to them in the past. And they'll have coverage that will be complete, and people with pre-existing conditions will also be able to get into those plans.
Nationwide, there is a monumental effort being launched to enroll racial, ethnic, and other minority communities. Cincy Hernandez-Cancio is director of health equity at Families USA.
While 13% of white, roughly 1 in 8, lack insurance, 18% of Asian and Pacific Islanders and American Indians, over 1 in 5 African Americans, and nearly 1 out of every 3 Latinos are uninsured. These extraordinarily high levels of uninsurance have historically been significant barriers for our communities to get the care they need. But the Affordable Care Act is truly a game changer. New, more transparent, reliable, and affordable coverage options are going to be available for millions of people, along with significant financial assistance for hard-working families well into middle-class level incomes.
I asked Elizabeth Benjamin to give me a concrete example of a financial advantage of Obamacare.
If your health insurance was costing $250 a month out of your paycheck and your paycheck was only $2,000, clearly you would be eligible to drop your employer coverage and go on to the health insurance marketplace and be able to do an apples-to-apples comparison of health insurance plans. You'll be able to seek and receive federal financial aid to help you buy health insurance. Financial aid will be available on the health insurance marketplace here in New York State for families of four who earn $94,200 a year. Even middle-income people will be able to get financial aid to help them offset the cost of their coverage.
With a January 1 deadline approaching when most Americans will be required to have health coverage or pay a fine, the New York Health Benefit Exchange, known as New York State of Health, has posted interactive tools and information on its website to help people calculate premiums and benefits. The link can be found at wamc.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
A new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looks at whether spraying yards with pesticides reduces the risk of contracting a tick-borne disease. In New York State, the study focused on Dutchess County. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
The CDC studied 2,500 households in Fairfield, Litchfield, and New Haven counties in Connecticut, Dutchess County in New York, and four counties in Maryland. Half of the yards were sprayed with bifenthrin, a widely used commercial pesticide. The other half was sprayed with a placebo, water. The result was a 60% reduction in ticks on the property sprayed with the pesticide. However, tick-borne illness and tick encounters among those residing at the properties treated with the pesticide were not reduced. Tick encounters signify ticks crawling or ticks attaching. Dr. Allison Hinckley is an epidemiologist with the CDC's Division of Vector-Borne Diseases.
This is the first study of its kind. We generally don't like to make policy decisions on a single study. However, it is very large, and it was done to the best of our abilities, so we feel fairly confident. We feel very confident in the results. However, prior to this, people recommended spraying, and there were no studies done to evaluate human disease. So I think it's important for us to evaluate as many prevention methodologies as possible so that we can utilize resources that will be to the best of their ability.
Dr. Richard Ostfeld is disease ecologist with the Millbrook-based Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Dutchess County.
So one interpretation is that 60% reduction in ticks just isn't good enough, that we need to do better. Maybe we need to reduce tick abundance by 90% or 95%. And that's a very sobering interpretation of this study, because I don't know that we're going to ever be very good at reducing tick populations by 90 or 95%. We're not going to do it with pesticides. Certainly controlling deer isn't going to do it.
Here's his second interpretation.
What it could mean is that people simply aren't encountering Lyme-bearing ticks on their own properties. They're encountering them somewhere else. So maybe people are getting exposed while they're out walking the dog, they're out picnicking or hiking or otherwise recreating. And so what this study tells me is that we really need to figure out where are people getting exposed, and that's where we should apply tick control.
The CDC's Hinckley, who delivered the presentation at the International Conference on Lyme Borreliosis and Other Tick-Borne Diseases in Boston, says more studies are needed.
Next, we'd like to evaluate other options for prevention. We also would like to be able to better understand where people are picking up ticks and acquiring disease so that we can target our prevention methods in the right environments.
The study on pesticides followed one released a few days earlier, in which the CDC found that preliminary estimates indicating the number of Americans diagnosed with Lyme disease each year is around 300,000. That's a figure roughly 10 times higher than the annual number of cases reported to CDC. Here's the Cary Institute's Ostfeld.
You know, other work, very good work that's being done by the CDC demonstrates that we have been underestimating the number of people in the U.S. that are exposed to and suffering from tick-borne illness. It's an even bigger problem than we already suspected that it was. And now we're finding that, that it's a tough nut to crack, that just spraying some pesticide on your lawn isn't going to do the trick.
Democratic State Senator Terry Gibson, whose district, most of Dutchess County and part of Putnam, is a Lyme disease hotspot, says the CDC study should help his legislation concerning tick-borne diseases.
I hope that it sends a message to my colleagues in the State Senate and the Assembly that it really is time for us to step up and take this issue seriously. I am, as you know, pushing a bill called the Tick Bite Act, which would hold insurance companies accountable to covering the cost of long-term illnesses associated with Lyme disease, and also a Doctor Protection Act, which would help cover doctors that are treating patients with Lyme disease. This is a big issue. It's not going away, And it's time that we as elected officials step up and take care of our constituents and do what needs to be done to make sure that they can live healthy and productive lives.
Democrat Kevin Cahill is sponsoring the Tick Bite Act in the Assembly.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government politics. I'm David Gustina. In acknowledgement of the 50th anniversary of the historic Civil Rights March in Washington, the Innovation Trail has been gathering voices from African-American business owners across New York. Vicki Brackens has been involved in the business and financial community in Syracuse for 30 years. She's a financial advisor and entrepreneur. The Innovation Trail's Ryan Delaney spoke with her about being a minority entrepreneur.
Are there enough minority or, you know, underprivileged parts of this community getting the chances to get involved or being reached to get involved in startups and innovations?
No. I probably should just stop right there, but the answer is no, and I'm not sure totally what the ultimate answer will be, but I think parts of the answer may be that we need to spend more time in communicating. And we also need to spend more time trusting each other. I do believe that if everyone would take at least one or two steps toward each other, that we could break down some tremendous barriers here in Syracuse.
Are we going in the right direction?
We're going in the right direction, okay? We're going in the right direction, but we have to work on the perception that it is not for me. And some of the perception is possibly true because there may have been some missteps early on.
Those missteps, can you elaborate on that at all?
Here's what I mean by missteps. Possibly initially, let's just say it that way, there wasn't as much collaboration from all communities in some of the decisions that were made. And that misstep may have created an environment that still lingers that my voice doesn't count.
Looking back 50 years and what's happened and what's changed, how much easier it is now as an African-American woman to be doing all of the things, you know, this lengthy resume that you have?
I'm an African-American woman who is in a technology business and in financial services, which is probably 98% male. So I'm not sure if easier is a good way of describing it. What I would say is that there's more recognition of the fact that we need to expand the base of individuals who are participating if we're going to solve some of these problems, okay? What I would say is easier, though, is the information is more accessible. There is a realization that all of us have to pull together, but we still have some barriers.
Hypothetical situation here. Say you're wandering the halls of the Southside Innovation Center and you bump into a 20-something African-American woman who's got a big cardboard box in her hands and just moving into, you know, office space down there, about to start her business. What would you tell her?
I think the first thing I would say is to understand that dreams do come true, but not overnight. Work is involved in making instant successes, okay? There's a lot of things that are happening in the background. So understand that dreams do come true, but they don't come true overnight. That you are going to have to face constant challenges, and adapting to your environment is important. And finally, if you don't succeed the first time, doesn't mean you were a failure. It may just mean it wasn't the right product or it wasn't the right time.
Vicki Brackens, an entrepreneur and financial mentor, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
That was the Innovation Trail's Ryan Delaney. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1334. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.